Each of these morning sessions, we're going to start with a short meditation to relax the body, relax the mind, and then hopefully set a good motivation for the day as well. So let's begin with a short meditation. So as always, we begin by preparing the body, setting the body in a state of ease and relaxation. So again, we can begin by allowing our awareness to descend into the body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Paying particular attention to the area of the face, mouth and jaw soft and relaxed, and all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. Simply allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And if you find it helpful, you can take 3 slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as you breathe. And simply allow the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. With each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And preparing the mind, setting it in a state of ease and relaxation. Letting go of any thoughts of the past or the future. Simply allowing the mind to come to settle in the stillness of the present moment. Simply becoming aware of sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you most distinctly notice any sensations related to the breath. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness. So that when you notice that you're becoming distracted, then simply relax and happily let go of the distraction and very gently return to focusing on the breath. And when you notice that you're simply becoming dull or spaced out, then use the in-breath as an opportunity to arouse and refresh your focus on the breath. And then think about your motivation for being here today. And try to set the best possible motivation you can for our time together today. As I briefly mentioned yesterday evening, we're going to be using the structure of this text here, the Great Treatise on the Stages of the Path to Enlightenment, or in Tibetan, Lamrim Chenmo, by Lama Tsongkhapa. We're going to be using this as the framework for our discussions. But what I'd like to do today is first, give a little bit of background, an overview of Buddhism in general, and in particular, look a bit at the mind this afternoon, so that we can have a good framework for beginning these discussions tomorrow. And as I also mentioned yesterday evening, to have a nice and relaxed approach for these days, both in the classes and in the meditations, and also to ask questions if you're not sure of what I'm saying or you have some doubts or confusion, because I think it's very helpful to be interactive, because if you have some confusion or doubt, then maybe a number of other people in the class have the same doubt, so if you raise the question, you're helping them as well. And that also gives me a sort of a gauge of whether you really understand everything's too easy or too difficult, and then I can sort of adjust my presentation accordingly. But again, with the questions, keep the questions to the topic. Otherwise, it's very easy to get sidetracked. And a lot of the things that you may be thinking about, we're also going to be covering later in this course, in this retreat anyway. So let's begin with a little background. So as I briefly mentioned in the meditation before breakfast, you know, we have all various different aspirations in our life, but I think one thing we all have in common is that we all simply want to be happy and we all want to be free of problems and suffering. That's something I think we all share in common. And we often feel as if the source of our suffering and the source of our happiness is out there. You know, it's other people and other things that are really the source of our suffering and the source of our happiness. And because of that, one of the main methods we use to try to find happiness and try to overcome our suffering and problems is we really try to manipulate the things around us. We really try to attract people, places and things that seem to be the source of our happiness. And then we also try to push away or avoid people, places and things that really seem to be the source of our suffering. So we end up in this sort of pull-push game, trying to manipulate the things around us. And of course, this takes a lot of time and energy to try to manipulate these things. But it seems, often seems that no matter how hard we try to do that, we still seem to encounter problems and suffering. And we still seem to be chasing after happiness. You know, maybe we've been doing this for many years, this approach. So it's often, you know, one step forward, two steps back. We don't seem to be getting very anywhere. And of course, if we don't get the things we want, then a lot of frustration often. And even if we get the things we want, they never really fully satisfy us, and we simply end up craving for more. In fact, recently I read a nice little quote from someone who said, there are two causes for unhappiness. The first one is not getting what we want, and the second one is getting what we want. I think that's probably true. And then, of course, we often also end up with a lot of dissatisfaction when things really don't live up to our expectations. So we're sort of stuck in this sort of hope-fear cycle, you know, hoping for pleasant things, fearing and worrying about unpleasant things. And this approach to trying to find happiness and trying to overcome suffering in Buddhism is presented with a topic called the Eight Worldly Concerns. And these eight worldly concerns are actually four pairs. One thing we're trying to get, and the other thing we're trying to avoid or push away. The first pair is gain and loss. And this is talking about material possessions and wealth. So we often feel as if source of happiness is having more stuff, more money, more possessions. So we put a lot of effort into accumulating wealth and possessions in the hope that that'll make us happy. And we often feel that if we don't really have a lot of wealth, money and possessions, that's really going to be the source of suffering. So we really try to avoid situations where we don't have possessions and wealth. And so, of course, in our modern society, then we see a lot of people putting a lot of effort into this, you know, trying to get a higher paid job, get more money so that we can have a bigger house, a bigger car, go on better holidays, eat better food, wear better clothing. All of these things really seem to be, you know, I mean, I think in our modern society, this has sort of been what's been pushed as the goal of life, is to really accumulate wealth, and that a measure of success in life is to have a lot of wealth and possessions. And so this is the first pair of gain and loss. The second pair is pleasure and pain. So we often also equate pleasure with happiness, meaning that the more pleasure we have, the more happy we will be. So we put a lot of effort into getting more pleasurable experiences. So eating and, you know, going to nicer restaurants, going on better holidays, you know, the sense pleasures, really putting a lot of effort in trying to have more sensory pleasure. And I think, unfortunately, in our modern society, it seems like that's in overload proportions. You know, we're talking about all these virtual realities and, you know, really overdosing on sense pleasures. Somehow that the more pleasure we have, the more happy we will be. And we often also equate any painful, unpleasant experiences with suffering. So we really try to avoid any situation where we engage, we happen to have any painful, unpleasant experience. So again, we put a lot of effort into these two things, trying to accumulate more pleasurable experiences and try to avoid any unpleasant experiences, in the hope that we'll become more happy and have less suffering. But not only do we put a lot of effort into these two things here, but we often feel that it's important what people are saying about us in terms of our happiness. So the third pair is praise and blame. Again, we put a lot of effort into trying to get into situations where people really are praising us for all the things we do. And that we really try to avoid situations where people are blaming us for things, particularly things that we never did. So again, we often feel it's very critical for our happiness, that it's really critical and important what people are saying about us. And then the fourth pair is that not only do we find it important for our happiness what people are saying about us, but also what people are thinking about us. So the fourth pair is good reputation and bad reputation. So again, we put a lot of effort often into trying to get a good reputation, and that people really are looking up to us and respecting us and so forth. So these are the eight worldly concerns. And so again, we often feel as if the more of these things that we can accumulate, the more happy we will be. That these things here are going to guarantee us happiness. And that these things here on the right, if we get them, unfortunately get them, that'll guarantee suffering for us. So this is what's called the eight worldly concerns. But again, is this approach really going to enable us to find fulfillment and genuine happiness and satisfaction in our life?
No.
In fact, often the more that we try to get the things on the left, the more unhappy we become. In fact, I just read something recently. What's the guy's name in China who I think he's now the wealthiest man in the world, the one who did the Alibaba? Yeah, he just recently said that because of his wealth, he's now really very unhappy, much more unhappy than he was before. I think that was just last week or something, there was an article, he said he's really completely unhappy because one of the things he said is that now he doesn't really have any friends because they all want something from him. So he said he's quite miserable now. This approach is problematic because a number of reasons is that this approach for finding happiness is a stimulus-based happiness, meaning that we often can't control the things around us, particularly if we're talking about other people. So if we're pinning our hopes of our happiness on other people behaving in a certain way, then I think we're in trouble. We're in deep trouble. And also, of course, being a stimulus-based happiness, it means that when the stimulus finishes, the happiness finishes as well. So it's not a stable, lasting type of happiness anyway. And even if we get these things on the left, there's not even a guarantee of having any sort of temporary happiness. Because often, even if we get the things on the left, it creates a lot of suffering. Because we're worried about losing these things. And this approach also, I think, in modern psychology is understood to really not be a very good approach. Because particularly when we're talking about, you know, gain and pleasure, we're talking really about what's, you know, a materialistic view of life. And even within psychology, a materialistic view of life is understood to not be a very good approach to life. In fact, I've got a quote here from a psychologist, and it's from a book called The High Price of Materialism from Tim Kasser, and he says, "Existing scientific research on the value of materialism yields clear and consistent findings. People who are highly focused on materialistic values have lower personal well-being and psychological health than those who believe that materialistic pursuits are relatively unimportant." So even in psychology, it's understood that not only is this approach not effective, but people who follow this approach, put a lot of emphasis in this approach, actually have lower mental well-being and psychological health than people who believe that this is not critical for happiness. Now, what we need to realize, of course, here is we are talking about the eight worldly concerns. Because often in Buddhism, when this is presented, it's then said that we need to give up the eight worldly concerns. And then often the term that is used in connection with this is the word renunciation. And so then you often hear people say that, you know, the entry point into the Buddhist spiritual path is renunciation. We have to give up the eight worldly concerns. And then people think, well, hang on, I don't think I want to be a Buddhist. Because to be a Buddhist, I have to give up my BMW, and I have to give up eating at nice restaurants, and I have to give up being praised and having a good reputation. Because if I have any of those things, I'm not a good Buddhist. Complete misunderstanding. Whether or not you have these is not the problem. The problem is our attitude towards them. What we're not talking about giving up the eight worldly things. We're talking about giving up the eight worldly concerns. So, what does concern here really mean? Concern really means here that we believe these are the source of happiness, these are source of suffering, and therefore we have a lot of attachment and craving for these things on the left, and we have aversion for the things on the right. So when we talk about renunciation, and we're talking about giving up the eight worldly concerns, we're not talking about giving up our BMW and eating nice meals and having a good reputation and so forth. We're talking about giving up attachment to these things. Giving up the idea that these things are going to make us happy, that they're the source of our happiness. So that's what we need to do, is we in terms of renunciation, we need to understand that these external things are not really the underlying source of our happiness, and to give up this craving and attachment for them. Because also the other thing that sometimes people see or think here is when we say give up the eight worldly concerns, then they go to the other extreme and they say, well, okay, then I won't have a job, I won't do anything because none of that's any good. Well, this is the other extreme, of course. So we're not saying, of course, for most of us we need to work to have enough money to have a roof over our head and clothes and food to eat and so forth. So we're not talking about that. Of course, these things are essential for most of us to survive in a reasonable way. What we're talking about is this concern of having attachment and aversion, believing that these things are really the underlying source of our happiness and suffering. This is what we need to give up. And that highlights here with this word renunciation another difficulty often that we find within Buddhism. Because actually, you know, it's true that this idea of renunciation is the entry point into the Buddhist spiritual path. But actually, this word renunciation, which is widely used, is a bad translation of the original Sanskrit and Tibetan term. Because the original Sanskrit term here is nisarana. And the Tibetan word here is ne chum. Ne means definite or certain. Chung means to emerge. So nisarana or ne chung is the aspiration to definitely emerge from this type of life we have. To definitely emerge and to strive for liberation from suffering. So this is what this original term means. It means in the book that we're following, it's translated as the determination to be free. To be free of suffering, to achieve liberation from suffering. This is what the term means. But unfortunately, very early on, that was translated as renunciation and it stuck. And so that's widely used now. But when we see this word renunciation as the entry point into the Buddhist spiritual path, we often have this mistaken belief that to be a good Buddhist, I have to give up all my money and possessions and pleasure in life. Not true. What we have to give up is the wrong attitude towards these things. I mean, we can have a lot of these things on the left and have renunciation. Or we can have none of this. We can be the most poor person in the world and have no renunciation. So again, the important thing is not whether or not we have them, it's our attitude towards them. As long as we have the attitude that this is going to guarantee me happiness, this is going to guarantee me suffering, and having attachment and aversion, then we have no renunciation, we're stuck. And we're going to be stuck in a cycle of hope and fear, and we're just going to suffer more. So this is what we're talking about here in terms of giving up the eight worldly concerns, is to give up this unhealthy attitude and correct our attitude. And so we can come to understand that the source of suffering and happiness is not really anywhere out there, it's within ourselves. And so part of this nisarana ne chung is also to understand this, that to wish to definitely emerge from suffering, to be liberated from suffering, understanding that the real source of that is within our own mind. This is really what renunciation means. Any questions on the eight worldly concerns? Yeah.
Do you think there's ever any limit where perhaps a possession, 12,000 square foot palace, a giant diamond or something, is such that it kind of communicates your attachment? It's like you can't really be unattached and have this possession. You can't. Don't tell me you have renunciation if you have.
So again, I think a sign of people who have renunciation, who have possession, is what are they doing with that? Are they using it to help society? or not.
Yeah.
So, of course, if we have more wealth, we can use that to benefit society. So that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, of course, assuming we accumulating that wealth in an ethical manner. Of course, this is the assumption in there. So, yes, but of course, if we are simply using that wealth for our own benefit, then I think we don't really have so much renunciation. And actually, there was a study done recently, going back to this, what was his name? Yeah. Related to that a little bit, is that they did a study where they had two groups of people, and they gave everyone in the two groups $100 at the beginning of the day. One group had to spend the $100 on themselves. The other group had to spend it on other people. And then they measured the level of happiness of these people at the end of the day. And the group who spent it on other people were more happy. So, you know, this idea.
I understand why gain and loss is materialistic, but I'm a little confused about pleasure and pain being materialistic, and I think that's because, for me, in my non-Buddhist head, pleasure and pain are either emotional or physical experiences.
Yeah, they're both
connected. They're not, and for me, having an expensive meal is not pleasure as compared to having a delicious cheap meal. So the materialistic piece.
I mean, often it often is the case in our modern society to be able to engage in a lot of these sense pleasures, we have to pay.
Right.
A lot of these, in our modern society, a lot of our sense pleasures don't come free. You know, we have to pay to go to a nice restaurant. We have to pay to get all this huge, big plasma screen where we can watch all the cable TV we want and big surround sound stereo at home and immerse ourselves. That costs money. So often it's
sense pleasures that don't cost money.
Oh, of course, there is. Yeah.
That.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah, sure. I mean, of course, yeah, there's a relation there.
I really appreciate the Tibetan. I'm curious, do you know what sarana means?
Yeah. Nisarana is the same. Generally you find, see, the Tibetan scriptural language didn't exist when Buddhism came to Tibet, and it was actually designed for Buddhism. So you find generally that Tibetan terms are very precise translation of the Sanskrit term, and often very literal. So Nisarana also literally means to emerge, to come out of.
Gotcha.
It means that.
I know in Sanskrit the ni is a negation.
Mm.
Of something, which sometimes that helps the thought process.
Mm.
And I'll track it down on my own.
Yeah.
Somehow I'm seeing like caterpillar to butterfly implied heavily in this whole that kind of emergence.
Yeah, I'm no Sanskrit scholar, but what I investigated here is this, again, this word Nisarana really means this wanting to get out of, to get away from, to emerge from. That's literally what it means. Okay. So then, from a Buddhist perspective, then, the source of happiness and the source of suffering is not out there. It's within our own mind. And so then we need to know the source of suffering and the source of happiness if we want to overcome suffering and to achieve happiness. And so here, in terms of happiness, we can talk about two types of happiness. There's what's called temporal happiness, which is what we tend to equate as happiness now. And so temporal happiness, of course, is the stimulus-based happiness, our pleasure. And so we tend now to try to find happiness, to chase after this temporal happiness. But of course, being a stimulus-based happiness, it's never really going to fully satisfy us and fulfill us, because when the stimulus finishes, the happiness finishes as well. Whereas genuine happiness is a happiness that is not stimulus-based. It's a state of happiness. It's a state of inner well-being that does not require any particular stimulus to be present to have this state of happiness. And so this is what the Buddha discovered 2,600 years ago, how to achieve this state of genuine happiness. Now, within this, then one way we can look at this is temporal happiness or pleasure is really what is about what we can get from the world. Whereas genuine happiness is not so much about what we can get from the world, but what we can bring to the world. And so this genuine happiness is really coming about through being in harmony with reality. And this is what the Buddha discovered 2,600 years ago. And so what I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about the history of Buddhism, how it began, and how then it sort of spread after the time of the Buddha, to give us a little bit of context for the text that we're going to start tomorrow. So it started in 563 BC in a place called Lumbini, which is now in modern day Nepal, southern Nepal. And at that time, a prince was born, Prince Siddhartha. The father was the king of the whole region. And when Prince Siddhartha was born, the sage, the wise man of the court, made a prophecy to the king and said that this child would either be a great king himself or a great spiritual leader. And of course, the king wanted the Prince Siddhartha to follow in his footsteps, so in his upbringing, he did everything possible to enable him to go in the direction of being the next king. So he surrounded him in the palace with a lot of the luxuries, a lot of the training and so forth to promote the prince to become a king. But as the prince was growing up, then he sort of started to understand that there's something wrong with this sort of approach to life. And in particular, he, on a number of occasions, went on a couple of trips outside the palace where he really saw the harsh realities of life. He saw aging, sickness and death. And also on one occasion he saw a wandering mendicant, a holy person who seemed to be very much at peace with themselves. And so these sorts of things got the prince really thinking about life and the meaning of life. But he was trapped in the palace, so he couldn't really do much about it. And so he then, at age 29, he escaped from the palace under the cover of darkness. He went out in search of the truth, the meaning of life. And at that time, there were already a number of sort of spiritual traditions flourishing in India. And a lot of them had the idea that to achieve liberation from suffering, to achieve that involved simply developing higher levels of samadhi, of concentration. Because as we develop higher levels of concentration, our mental afflictions such as attachment and craving and so forth subside. And it was felt that if we really develop those to the highest level, we can overcome all of our mental afflictions and suffering. So then the prince had a number of teachers early on who really taught him these practices of developing higher levels of samadhi. And he really developed all the levels of samadhi. And part of that, of course, was the idea of transcending craving and attachment. In particular, craving and attachment for the body. So part of the practices also was to deny the body. So a lot of ascetic practices were involved, like not feeding the body, starving the body. So the prince engaged in these practices for about 6 years. And then at that point, he was almost on the verge of death from starvation. And at that point, he really understood something. He understood that actually in his earlier life in the palace, he was caught up in the extreme of indulgence, of sensory pleasure. But he really understood that actually he'd just now gone to the other extreme of asceticism, of denial. And so he understood that this is not the way to liberation. So he abandoned his teachers and went out on his own in search of the truth. And so what happened next, I'd like to actually read from this book here, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, from Tsongsa Khyentse. I mean, some of you may have heard of him. He also has made a couple of movies, Tibetan movies, The Cup and Travelers and Magicians, and I think he's got a new movie out recently or so. He has a very nice explanation about what happens next in Prince's quest. So I'll just read that out. And this is on, I think, on page 33, if anyone has the book. Through many years of contemplation and penance, Siddhartha remained steadfast in his determination to find the root cause of suffering and to ease his own suffering and the suffering of others. He headed to Magadha in the heart of India to continue his meditation. Along the way, he met a grass seller named Sotia, who offered him a handful of kusha grass. Siddhartha recognized this as an auspicious sign. In ancient Indian culture, kusha grass was considered a cleansing substance. Instead of continuing his journey, he decided to stop and meditate right there. He found a place to sit on the flat stones under a nearby ficus religiosa tree, using the kusha grass as a mat. Silently he vowed, "This body may rot, I may disintegrate into the dust, but until I find the answer, I will not rise." As Siddhartha sat in contemplation beneath the tree, he did not go unnoticed. Mara, the king of the demons, heard Siddhartha's vow and sensed the strength of his resolve. Mara grew sleepless, for he knew that within Siddhartha existed the potential to throw his entire domain into chaos. Being a strategic warrior, he sent five of his most beautiful daughters to distract and seduce the prince. As the girls set out, they had full confidence in their seductive talents. But as they approached the meditating Siddhartha, their beauty began to vanish. They withered and aged, they grew warts, and a stench rose from their skin. Siddhartha did not stir. The dejected apsaras returned to their father, who was furious. How dare anyone refuse his daughters? In his rage, Mara summoned his retinue, a great army furnished with every imaginable weapon. Mara's army attacked in full force, but to their dismay, all the arrows, spears, stones, and catapults aimed at Siddhartha transformed into a rain of flowers as soon as they came within reach of their target. After many long hours of unsuccessful warfare, Mara and his army were exhausted and defeated. Finally, Mara came to Siddhartha and, with all his diplomacy, tried to talk him into giving up his quest. Siddhartha said he could not give up after all these lifetimes of trying. Mara asked, "How can we be so sure you have been struggling for so long?" Siddhartha answered, "I don't need validation. The earth is my witness." And with this he touched the ground, the earth shook, and Mara evaporated into thin air. Thus, Siddhartha found liberation and became a Buddha. He had discovered the path to end suffering at its very root, not only for himself but for all people. The place of his final battle against Mara is now called Bodh Gaya, and the tree under which he sat is called the Bodhi tree. This is the story that Buddhist mothers have told their children for many generations. So when we look at that story, of course, we can, if we want, we can accept it literally, that there was this demon Mara and there was these daughters and there was this army there attacking Siddhartha. But as we're going to see in our Lam Rim discussions, Mara, the daughters and the army are symbolic of three inner demons in our own mind that we need to overcome. And so it's these three inner demons that, symbolized by Mara, the daughters and the army, that Prince Siddhartha vanquished from his own mind, and then he achieved enlightenment, became a Buddha. So when he achieved enlightenment, then Prince Siddhartha came to be known as Buddha Shakyamuni. So the word Buddha here in Tibetan, of course, is Sangye. And the word Buddha here has two sort of connotations. One is that a Buddha is someone who is has purified their mind completely, meaning has eliminated all suffering and its causes, but also someone who's completely awakened, someone who has fully developed all the positive qualities, such as loving kindness and compassion. And then here, Shakyamuni. Shakya is the clan or group of people that Prince Siddhartha grew up in with. And Muni, in Sanskrit, can have many meanings. Here, it means someone who has a lot of capacity or strength. So here we're talking about someone who has a lot of capacity and strength to help others to be liberated from suffering. So Shakyamuni Buddha, or Buddha Shakyamuni, is the completely awakened one from the Shakya clan who has a lot of capacity or strength to help liberate others from suffering. So that's a little bit the history up until the time that Prince Siddhartha achieved enlightenment. And again, he achieved enlightenment in Bodh Gaya, in modern-day Bihar state. Then he understood what he had discovered was very profound and that maybe people wouldn't really understand what he had discovered. But then he remembered five of his teachers who he thought might be able to comprehend what he had discovered. So he went out in search of them. And he heard that they were in the area around Sarnath, which is near modern-day Varanasi. So he set out in search for them, and he came to Sarnath, and then he gave his first teaching to these five ascetics who were previously his companions and teachers, and he taught them the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths was the very first teaching he gave, and the Four Noble Truths is the foundation of all Buddhist traditions. And so after the break this morning, I'm going to give a little bit of an overview of the Four Noble Truths, so this can be a part of the framework for when we go into the Lam Rim text tomorrow. What I'll do before the break is introduce a an analogy for the Four Noble Truths, because often when a new concept is being introduced, to help understand that concept, often in the texts or teachings you'll be given a simple analogy to better relate to that concept. And so here in the Four Noble Truths teachings, or what the Four Noble Truths means, we often come across the analogy of a physical illness. So if we have, or we suspect we have, a physical illness, then what is generally the first thing we would do?
Go to a
doctor. And what would generally be the first thing that the doctor would do?
Examine you. Give you an examination.
Yeah, what's that called? What's the word for that?
A physical.
Diagnosis.
Diagnosis, yes. So the doctor would try to diagnose our problem. And usually the diagnosis has sort of two parts to it. The first is that the doctor would have a look at the various symptoms that we're displaying. You know, maybe do a blood test, checking the pulse and running various tests. And then from that, seeing what sorts of symptoms we're displaying. From those symptoms, then the doctor would look at that and try to understand what could be the underlying illness that is presenting these symptoms. So that we have these sort of two steps in the diagnosis. And the analogy that we're using here is a curable illness. So what comes after diagnosis?
Treatment.
Before treatment.
Prescription.
Before that.
Prognosis.
Prognosis, yes. So based on the tests and so forth that the doctor ran, and then based on his understanding of what would be the underlying illness that is presenting itself as these symptoms, the doctor would then go on to giving us the prognosis, saying that I believe you have such and such an illness, and this illness can be cured or can't be cured, or whatever the case may be. But here the analogy that we're using is the analogy of a curable disease. So the prognosis here would be then that you have this illness and the prognosis is we can cure that. So then, of course, from prognosis comes the cure, the remedy. So what we can see is that there are these three, or we can say four, steps in the process. So similarly, the Four Noble Truths. In the Four Noble Truths, that the Buddha is being like our doctor. That in the First Noble Truth, he is, as part of his diagnosis, he is describing our symptoms. What is our current condition that we find ourselves in? And so the First Noble Truth is often translated as the truth of suffering, that our condition is one of suffering. But here we also run into terminology problems. And often a lot of confusion and doubt in Buddhist teachings that we hear is simply because of terminology. And often you'll find that there are a lot of terms from Sanskrit and Tibetan which have very precise meaning, but in English language there is no word that has that precise meaning. So often then the translator is forced to pick a word that sort of is close, most close to that. But unfortunately, sometimes, as with renunciation, the translator, the early translators, didn't really appreciate what the word meant, and so they actually picked a word that actually is very misleading. Or sometimes there just simply is no word that has that same meaning. So then the translator is forced to pick a word that closely resembles it. And so often then the word that is picked here is suffering. But the original word in the Four Noble Truths is, what is our current condition? It's dukkha. And the problem with this, of course, is this word suffering, is that when we hear the word suffering, for us that generally means some sort of unpleasant, painful physical or mental experience. And so here, of course, in the Four Noble Truths, this is the Buddha's diagnosis for our current condition. So often you'll hear people say, according to Buddhism, all life is suffering. And then when we hear that, we go, ooh, that doesn't sound right. Because sometimes I have, you know, happiness in my life. Sometimes I have pleasurable experiences. So I don't agree with that. I think the Buddha got it wrong. The problem here, of course, is the word. That this is a translation of dukkha, but dukkha has a much broader meaning than what we normally associate with this word suffering. So that's what the confusion is. And I'll explain shortly what this word dukkha really means. So that when we see, and of course this is the most common way this is translated, so that when we see then in the Four Noble Truths this truth of suffering, we can better appreciate what are we talking about here. And we're not talking about the fact that all of our life is simply unpleasant, painful, physical, mental experiences. We're not saying that. Then, of course, what is the second noble truth is the underlying illness, the underlying cause of the symptoms. So the second truth is the truth of the cause or origin of suffering or dukkha. And in Sanskrit, this is samudaya. Then, of course, this was the Buddha's diagnosis for us, that we are stuck in this state of dukkha, and he went on to describe what is the underlying cause or origin of this state. But then, of course, the Buddha's prognosis was very good, was that we can be cured from this state of dukkha. We can overcome dukkha or suffering. We can be liberated from suffering. And so the third noble truth is the truth of cessation, the truth of the ending of suffering and its causes. And in Sanskrit, this is Nirodha. So the Buddha's prognosis was that we can achieve, we can be liberated from this current state of suffering or dukkha. We can achieve a state, a cessation, the ending of all suffering and its causes. And then the cure. What is the cure? What is the medicine that we need to take to achieve this state of cessation of suffering and its causes? That fourth noble truth. The truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And here, path in Sanskrit is marg. So this is how this we can use this analogy of a curable illness to understand the Four Noble Truths. And so within these Four Noble Truths, the Buddha went on to say that, you know, he described each one and he said, dukkha or suffering is to be known. Because like a physical illness, if we don't know we're stuck in a state of suffering, then we're not going to take any steps to overcome it. So unless we know what our current condition really is, then we're not going to think that there's really a problem, or we don't know what the problem is, that there even is even a problem. We think, well, this is just normal, I just go on like this. And then, of course, when we know suffering, then the cause or origin of suffering, the underlying illness, the Buddha said this is to be eliminated. Because if we don't eliminate the underlying cause, we're not going to get rid of the suffering. Of course, we can do a lot to mask symptoms and suppress symptoms, but unless we tackle the underlying illness, unless we get rid of that, then we're not going to be cured. So we are to eliminate the cause or origin of suffering or dukkha, and then cessation, of course, is something to be attained, to be achieved, to achieve this healthy state, to be liberated from suffering. And then, of course, the cure, the medicine, the path, is to be cultivated or practiced. Because unless we cultivate the path, we're not going to achieve this goal of cessation. So again, in the Four Noble Truths, suffering is to be known, the cause of suffering is to be eliminated, the cessation of suffering is to be achieved, and to do that, the path is to be cultivated or practiced. So this is a very brief introduction into the Four Noble Truths using this analogy. Is there any questions on this? Yeah.
Why are they called Noble Truths?
Okay. Again, I think this word noble sometimes can be misleading. This word noble here is a translation of a Sanskrit word, arya. And in the spiritual path, there are two types of practitioner. There's the what's called the ordinary practitioner and then the arya practitioner. And an arya is someone who has already had a direct realization of the nature of reality. Meaning that for someone who's had this, these things are true. They know these things. Now we don't know these things. Maybe intellectually we can sort of appreciate them, but we don't directly experience things in this way. We don't know this. So when we, through the practicing the path, we get to the point where we have a direct realization of the nature of reality, then these things really become true for us. We realize them directly. So these things, these are four truths for noble people, Arya beings. This is what Four Noble Truths mean. Any other questions? Okay. It's time for a morning tea break. So we'll have 30-minute morning tea break. We'll come back at 10:45 and then we'll have a look at each of these Four Noble Truths in a little bit more detail. which is going to help us to, as a basis framework for our discussions later. And also what I'd like to do is have a look at one particular other set of teachings from the Buddha that is relevant to this Lam Rim. And then at the end of the next session is have a look at then how, on the basis of these teachings that the Buddhism spread from India to all the various countries, in particular how it spread into Tibet. Because this text, of course, is from Lama Tsongkhapa, a great Tibetan master. So we can see then how these various teachings managed to find their way to Tibet and form the basis of this. Okay, but that's all after the break. So let's take 30-minute morning tea break. Come back at 10:45.